So I guess now's the time I'm supposed to say stuff, right? So, on to the next program, the Dhamma Talk. So it's, you know, actually, while I was meditating, that catchphrase of Ajahn Brahm, which I'm sure you've all heard, happy to be here, popped up in my mind, because I thought, how nice to be here with you all. And also, to be here in a different way, because I remember we were staying at the nun's vihara in the afternoon, and I remember the first time I came to stay there was as a layperson when I was visiting Perth. I lived in Thailand, but I came as a layperson to live in, try out the monasteries in Perth, and I stayed here for maybe, can't remember, was it about 2 months? So I split my time between Bodhinyana and Dhammasara. And when I was at Dhammasara, Lynn Jackson back then would come offer dana every week. And I was kind of like, can I go to those one of those Dhammaloka weekends that, you know, you read about in the enlightened times, in the olden days when it was a paper copy, and in the back they had all this, like, all these programs at Dhammaloka. And it seemed all very, I don't know, it's like, wow, I could actually do it after reading about it in the enlightened times for all these years. And she very kindly said yes, and very kindly let me stay at the nun's vihara. So so it's interesting to be back again, staying at the same place, but now in an official capacity. And also there's, if any of you have watched, I mean, even if you come here, or whether you watch on YouTube from overseas, this is like the iconic blue carpet place, you know, that you see in the video. So it's kind of cool to be sitting here in the iconic blue carpet place, and the iconic seat. so that's it's all kind of fun, and it kind of makes me feel a bit sort of like, yeah, in the mood to reflect back on this whole journey, you know, even before that, I had been interested in Buddhism and practicing, but also this weekend happens to coincide with, let me quickly do the math. 14 years ago was when I became a novice nun, a seminary, in Thailand, at a monastery in Thailand, but it was on July the 2nd, which is this Sunday now. But I'm sure if you look up on the internet and figure out when was July 9 July 2 in 2009, maybe it was a Friday. So maybe this is actually the day. I don't know. But it's kind of funny how quickly it goes, how fast it passes, but also in many ways how things feel very different also now in July 2nd or June 30, you know, back in 2009. So it's one of those things where you're like, yeah, how did I get here? and actually, you know, it's it took a little bit of time. I mean, I remember, I would kind of, because I had actually come across Ajahn Brahm's teachings back in 2005, but before I could actually come here to stay the first time in 2008, there's a little time it took me, you know, of like, kind of like, you know, okay, checking out, looking at their website, and back then the website was much more simple. I remember there was like, I don't know, like this hand-drawn map to how to get to Bodhinyana, like, you know, and like this, and like it was just like this, I think one page paragraph, like very, very simple, very short description of Dhammasara. But I remember noting well to myself that in Perth, there is a monastery for nuns, independent. And they seem to be, you know, able to meditate and not cook all day. So I thought, note to self. And you know, I actually printed it out, because I'm a very organized person. I have filing cabinet with folders, you know, that kind of person. And so I filed it in my, I forget what the folder was called, but you know, it was filed for future reference. So so, you know, it's percolating in the back of my mind, but you know, it takes a bit of time. You know, going back to the website every so often over the years and kind of just checking it out, thinking about it. But yeah, I mean, I guess before the causes and conditions to actually be able to come and stay that first time, it took a bit of time and a bit of repetitiously inclining the mind towards this idea. And so, you know, Auntie Romney's sitting right here, so yeah, it's like, it calls to mind the story she told us just the other day when she came to visit Dhammasara just a few days ago. She told this story about this very lovely 10-precept nun in Sri Lanka and how she became a nun. And boy, that's a good story. So, I mean, like, it's like straight out of, you know, the suttas. It's this young 16-year-old girl, you know, just happens, you know, her two grandmother just wanted to go and, you know, go and they wanted to ordain as a nun, was that right? They wanted to go spend some time in the nun's monastery. I think they wanted to ordain. And then she went along just to, you know, like as moral support. And then when she got there, she was sitting in the Dhamma hall and she looked at the Buddha statue. And she felt like the Buddha, like, blinked at her. Y'all look at the Buddha statue now. Is he blinking at you? but yeah, she had this moment of feeling like I think he blinked at me. And that was like some kind of sign that's it somehow spoke to something deep in her heart and it kind of catalyzed something where she's like, I gotta become a nun. You know, and like, and literally like, you know, went to the senior nuns of the place and like, I can't quite remember Auntie Romney's words, something like cried and carried on, made such a fuss, you know, that they were kind of like, okay, well, get it in writing from your parents that they're okay with this and we'll do it, you know, or we'll ordain you. And so if you are parents, this is how you deal with your 16-year-old child wailing to become a nun. You're like, is this some kind of teenage crisis? Or is this, what is going on? So her parents very wisely let her do it. but they had the idea that we'll take her home and she'll come to her senses. So they let her do it and she ordained as a nun. And then like 5 days later, they're like, okay, now's the time to come home. You know, you can still be a nun, wear your nun clothes, but you know, come home. And sort of gave her a talking to that, no, you can't do this. This is not practical. You're still taking your O-levels. You must finish school or, you know, you can't do this. And if anyone ever has read, you know, the Ratapala Sutta, this is the way you deal with parents when they say no. And she just kind of wouldn't give up and was really kind of like, no, I really want to. This part I'm ad-libbing. I don't know actually what she said because I don't speak Sinhala. But, you know, yeah, no, I really, no, please, no, I know, take me back to the monastery, blah, blah, blah. Something of the effect of like, you know, standing her ground, as any good teenager will do. And they let her. After 5 days, they're like, okay, she's serious, so we'll take her back. And they did. And in this story, this is not some just teenage tantrum. She went back, and she stayed in robes till today. And so now I think she's in her early 30s or something, so she can already say, I've spent half my life in the robes. But there's a dramatic story where you're like, where's the slow process of inclining the mind? It was just like, he blinked at me and he had me at blink, you know, like, and then she left and she became a nun. So you think of those stories in the suttas where people just say, they listen to a, you know, a Dhamma talk from the Buddha and they're like, oh, Master Gotama, may I have the going forth, may I have the Upasambada, the full ordination, and it's all very like dramatic. And you're like, I thought it was a gradual training. but no, you know why it was dramatic? Why the Buddha blinked at her was probably because she had done this so many times already in previous lives that it was just like, right, it's clear, I must continue. And so there had been a process of inclining the mind that had been going on before then, you know, slowly, gradually, until it had such a power that it spoke to her with such force in this life. My version is much more humble, but I have to say, you know, if I look back on, you know, yeah, that question you get all the time about why did you become a nun, but here's a different question. When's the first time you knew you wanted to become a nun? Or when's the first time you had that bit of a little inkling that this might be something for me? And it might not even be in such a clear, you know, such a clearly thought out idea. But when I look back now, I remember. How many of you have watched Sound of Music? You know, with Julie Andrews and the gambling and the Swiss Alps and all this stuff. Yes, yes. Right. But I remember, I watched it the first time, maybe when I can't remember how old I was, but I was still a little kid. And I sort of remember, you know, that in the early part of the movie where, you know, all the Mother Superior and all the nuns are trying to figure out how to solve a problem like Maria. How do you take a cloud and pin it down? And the cloud goes off and is, you know, it's not going to be pinned down and, you know, declares her freedom and how she has confidence in herself and yay, and, you know, running around freely in the Alps. And I remember my reaction was not, hooray, Maria. It was kind of like a little bit sad, like, but why did you leave the convent? Like, that seems like a nice place to be. And it was, you know, it's not like but it was just like an instinctual feeling of my reaction. I was like, this is not the reaction of the other people in the movie theater house. Like, it's like, I kind of felt like, but wouldn't it be better to stay with the nuns? And yeah, that might have been my first inkling. That might have been, you know, the sign that, yes, this is going to happen one day. But my journey was much more gradual. But still, that means that there's something there. There's something there. And where is it from? It's from some kind of inclination. And where does that inclination come from? That inclination comes from doing it before, perhaps, you know? And so I was thinking of this word incline, and I have the luxury now, unlike, oh, the monastics of yore who had to, you know, remember the suttas by heart. I typed in like incline. No, and I didn't actually type incline. I remembered there's like suttas that taught, they had this phrase, you know, slant slopes inclines. And so I thought it'd be easier to search for slants because that's a more random word. So I typed in slant and see what came up. So it's not that I know the suttas by heart. I know how to enter the search name. So I entered slant, and there was like a whole bunch that have this whole, you know, this stock passage about how just as the River Ganges slant slopes and inclines towards, there's two options, either it goes towards the east or it goes towards the ocean. Just as River Ganges slant slopes and inclines towards the ocean, so too a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni who practices the Noble Eightfold Path slant slopes and inclines towards Nibbana. So Nibbana is like fancy way to say freedom from suffering or true happiness. It's basically what it means. And so there's a whole bunch of other suttas that talks about how, yeah, either it's cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path or the, you know, maybe the seven factors of enlightenment or the four foundations of mindfulness or the five powers or Ajahn Brahm will love this, or the four jhanas, you know, all of this is slant, slopes, inclines towards Nibbana. That's how you do it. And so I thought, right, slant, slopes, and inclines, like the mighty River Ganges. But how does that, you know, the River Ganges, yes, it's like this mighty river that will rush out to the end, to the sea, from the Himalayas where it starts to the Bay of Bengal. And I actually lived in Bangladesh when I was a little kid. So I know what it, you know, where the River Ganges meets the Bay of Bengal is, it's like, it's a very soft, fertile soil there because there's so much water coming out. The force of this mighty river finally entering the sea. Yeah, it's a powerful kind of slant, slopes, and inclines, baby. I mean, that's really like majorly, you know, slant, sloping, and inclining towards something. But I thought, well, how are rivers formed, you know? How is this mighty Ganges River that's inclining towards the sea, how was it formed? And again, I have the luxury of Google, because who can remember their geography class from fifth grade, you know? roughly, but no, not enough to be able to like make sense of it. So yeah, you know, you look it up, and yeah, it's a process of millions of years, you know, before a river is formed. And if you're talking about the Himalayas, you know, the water is coming from the ice that's melting from the Himalayas is coming down rock face. Anyone who's ever been to the Himalayas? Any of you ever been to the Himalayas? Yeah, right? Any of you trekked on it, climbed it, scaled Mount Everest, perhaps, to anybody? But, you know, you don't have to do that to know that that stuff is rock. To be able to carve some kind of path in that rock is not the kind of thing you do in a day. So how rivers formed is that water from the source, it starts flowing down in little streams down the mountain. Little streams, they start to create some kind of a groove so that the water flow starts to become sort of like directed. And then those streams, little streams all over the mountain, they start to merge and collect until they start to have enough momentum to create a flow. And that flow goes down from the mountains, you know, to more lower level areas where other sources of water merge into them. And then they become wider and more powerful. And so even though they no longer have the force of gravity of a mountain slope, they're still able to keep moving, you know, and they keep flowing out until they can find some way to empty out into a body of water that's bigger, which is the ocean. And so that process of creating, you know, the pathway of a river is something that takes time. And it's something that takes sheer repetition. It's like water flowing over the same groove again and again and again and again until it actually creates some kind of pattern and a groove that becomes like deeper and wider. And that's something that uncannily calls to mind, you know, how modern neurologists talk about how neural pathways are created in your brain. Is any sort of activity you do or any thought pattern that you have that's like done again and again, it creates some kind of groove in your brain in the way your neural pathways are created, where the groove becomes more established, and so the signals are sent more easily down the same pathway. So that's like a fancy scientific way to say that's how habits are formed. That's how inclinations of behavior and mind, body and speech are formed. They're formed through doing it again and again. Like, how simple is that? You know, just do it again and again. And you know, actually, that's in that passage, you know, about how developing and cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path is how you can incline the mind towards true happiness. that second word, cultivate, that's how it's translated into English. But if you actually look at the Pali word, what it actually literally means is to do many. So basically, to do a lot, to do many times, to do it a lot, to do it again and again and again and again. And that's how you can create an inclination in your mind and pray that it be a wholesome one. So, if you are you're inclining your mind in ways that are not so wholesome, you may not be inclining towards the east or the ocean. You might be inclining towards some terrible desert or something, I don't know. but inclinations go both ways. So that's where the tricky part is. But also, the thing is, you know, you can kind of see in your own life, I'm sure many of you have practiced for many years, you can look back and see how so humble beginnings, they gather momentum. So look back to your own humble beginnings. In my mood of nostalgia, I shall look back to my first day in a monastery. You know, it was just like 3 or 4 days, like something like that. It was at this monastery of a very great, now deceased, master in the forest tradition of Thailand, Ajahn Ban or Longpu Ban. Ajahn Ram spent some time there when he was a young monk. And when I stayed there, I remember thinking, one of my like strongest memories of it, aside from it was inspiring, and I did do some meditation, but man, oh man, was I hungry in the evenings! Like that was the first time I ever kept 8 precepts, you know, like for a few days in a row, I was like hungry. Like every day, I'd be like, wow, you know. I'm glad this dark chocolate business is allowable. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to eat in this much quantity as an allowable, but I am hungry. So that was one of my main memories of this. There are other much more positive memories, but this was definitely one that I remember. I remember the last day when we left, like how relieved I was that we were going to have dinner. Like we went to some restaurant and like how relieved I was. I was like, oh, thank God, dinner again. So that's something. And the other thing I remember struggling with was like, I mean, it's the first time staying in a monastery with, you know, one of the 8 precepts, like no entertainment, like no TV. I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to fill the hours? Like, yeah, you eat and, you know, one meal a day. So that's like one activity done, finished. And then you have your whole afternoon stretching out in front of you with the options being to meditate or what, you know? And so luckily, this is actually how I came across Ajahn Brahm's teachings. Luckily, my relative had been given this book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, you know, just published. Remember the days back in the day when it was just published? Just published. And I was like, and he let, you know, very kindly loaned it to my sister and I was like, oh, stories, like good ones, like entertaining stories. I'm like, kosher entertainment can keep 8 precepts and yet still feel somewhat entertained. So that is how I managed to pass by the 4 days. So that was my first day in a monastery, you know? But the thing is, over time, I spent more time in other monasteries and that kind of thing. And I actually really grew to appreciate the 8 precepts. And I remember after that time when I spent in Perth, where I was here for almost 2 months, I remember when I left the monastery, I actually had a feeling of like, gosh, I wish I didn't have to give up the 8 precepts, you know, like, and also I had gotten used to it, so I was no longer starving in the evenings, but there was this sense of like, it was such a like simple lifestyle and such a safe lifestyle, where you were just doing no wrong, and you were so peaceful because of that, and I kind of was like, I rued the thought of having to go and read a menu in a restaurant, have to pick what to eat, kind of thing. Like it just seemed like, what a letdown, you know, like rather than think, oh great, now I can actually choose what I want to eat, it was sort of like, oh, what a complication, I have to think about what I have to eat, you know. And so you see, over not even that long, over 3 years, your attitude towards the same thing can shift, because you've done it again and again, and you've done it more. And the more you do it, the more you begin to feel in your own experience the benefits of it. And the more you experience the benefits of it, then the more inclined you are to do it again and again, even more. And then it's like it becomes this virtuous cycle, and that's how the momentum grows. But you know, these things, they're not that easy to do at first. And so it's useful to remember this when at first this doesn't seem easy, but yeah, that's okay. How easy it is to carve a kind of groove in the Himalayan rock face, you know? How easy is that? But it can be done if you just keep doing it again and again. And it's all right if there are periods when you're just like not inspired, or you feel kind of discouraged in the practice in some way, and you want to turn away for a little while. Like I remember, you know, it's trying to start to meditate and have some kind of like feeling that it actually led to some difference in your mind, you know, like, yes, I remember reading, you know, basic method of meditation, that booklet. And when you get to the part when he's talking about, oh, the silent mind, so the beauty of the silent mind. And I remember thinking, what silent mind? Like, what is he talking about? What is this? And feeling really, you know, after doing it for a while, and being like, I still don't understand what he means by the silent mind, feeling quite frustrated and sort of feeling like, like almost like, I don't want to hear you talk about the silent mind, you know, because it's like if I don't know what it means. It means somehow like this is very far off or very irrelevant to my current level of experience, and it was also almost like discouraging. And so there was a period when I was kind of like right meditation, and not so keen. But then there's another part of you where, you know, despite yourself, despite your feeling of discouragement, there is already that process of inclining that's happening. It's beginning to slant ever so slightly, slope ever so subtly, but it is. And so you may veer off for a little bit, like as the water is going down the mountainside, it might veer off, you know, from the main groove that's starting to form. But then it can come back and join it. So that's sometimes when you take a bit of a detour in your practice because you're just feeling a bit frustrated, you know, and perhaps they want to, I don't know, just go out and potty or something, whatever it is, you know, your way of rebelling against the virtuous lifestyle. And but then you're like, but no, that's just not as fulfilling. And then you come back and you get back into the groove. And so I guess, and you know, this is sort of a encouragement that like when we go through those periods, don't take them too seriously, you know, and like it doesn't mean that it can't go back to the groove, or that there is no groove that is forming. It's just that it takes time. And also sometimes, you know, you need to make the same mistake a few times. That's part of inclining. As I was thinking about, oh yes, 14 years ago I became a nun, I decided to look up this old diary. I had kept a diary of my first year as a nun, you know, very intermittently, like very intermittent entries. And many of these entries are just like summaries of like, when I have time, I'll write the full entry, but here are the basic ideas. And I have to say, I sort of gave up doing it after a year because, you know, what time do you have in the monastery to be writing diaries? Like, you know, you'd rather use that time to meditate if you had any free time. So then my diary was sort of a very short-lived project. But nonetheless, a very interesting, because, you know, you kind of forget the words you would use or the things you would say 14 years ago. But I had this entry about, like, you know, like some... some victory. I think the title was sort of some kind of victory that I felt, because I had this incident where we're not even talking the 8 precepts, we're talking even just the 5 precepts. The one about lying, you know? Like there's something in there where you might not be telling a bald-faced lie, but there's a little bit of something, a little bit of dissembling, where you just don't want to look bad, you know? So in this incident, some more senior nun had asked me to do some task, and, you know, I hadn't quite done it yet. But I had reasons, you know, but the way that I had said it was like sort of like this vague way, which is not actually a lie, but it could lead her to believe that I had actually done it already. You know, it was very, you know, cleverly, like, you know, straddling that lie and non-lie, technically not a lie, but, you know, and when she was led falsely to believe that I had done it, there was a period when I let it be, and it was like, right, well, I didn't actually lie. But the victory was that only a few minutes later or something, I was like, no, I didn't do it. Like, I actually told her, like, you blurt out that, no, really, I didn't do it. And so there was something in me that had, like, had made that mistake so many times, or you, I'm sure you've done this too, where you just sort of slightly dissemble and futz a little bit, so you just look a bit better to people. You don't look like you did something wrong, or you didn't do what you're supposed to do, and you were still the good girl, you know? And I must have done, in my entry, I was saying, yeah, because you have to make that similar mistake enough times for you to build up enough of that sense of, like, you know, moral dread and moral shame, you know, technically the hiri otapa, you know, that sense of like, no, I can't do this again. Like, you know, like this is a lie basically, isn't it? And that because I had remembered being in similar situations, reacting in a similar way so many times, that this time I just couldn't take it anymore. Like there was enough of that sense of dread and shame of wrongdoing had come up, that in this instance it pushed me to actually, no, I have to tell you the truth. And so that's, sometimes that's part of it. Like when you've made a mistake, like rather than think that, oh no, now I'm just oy vey, I'm off the path, I'm far. But no, it's actually, no, this mistake is gonna help you if you reflect on it in the right way. It's gonna help you actually be more firm on the path. So all those times that I had dissembled before were not for naught. If you use it in the right way, if you use it in the way to incline towards the east, you know, then actually it's really valuable stuff, your mistakes. And so that's something which, gosh, you know, like, thought I was keeping the 5 precepts for like ages already, but no, you know, to actually do it well and to do it consistently, that also takes a process of, yes, again and again. And so this is where, you know, we can keep refining our practice, and especially as a bhikkhuni, you know, when you have to do what we do when we every 2 weeks is you have to gather and listen to the recitation of the Patimokkha, the monastic rules that we have to keep, and before you can listen to it, you have had to confess any offenses where you've transgressed any of those rules, and you let another nun know, and they give you a bad harassment. No, they don't. They just say, oh, okay, do you see your mistake? Okay, try better next time. Be more restrained. It's okay. You know, that's basically all you have to do. But because you have to do it, it actually makes it even more clear in your mind when you actually have made a mistake. And more clear in your mind that, like, because you say, yes, I will be more restrained in future, you have to think, well, how will I be more restrained in future? How am I gonna like avoid getting to the situation again? How am I gonna avoid making the same mistake again? Because you actually have to tell somebody and you've actually promised to them that I will be more restrained. So it has a certain weight that's even like more than just when you make a mistake and you realize it on your own. So there's sort of a structure and formality around it that helps you actually even be firmer in your practice of refining your virtue and refining your morality. And so that's something which really helps. You know, there are some habits that really, you know, like the one about, you know, oh, speech is a really big one, but like the one about, like, you know, not kind of like gossip, like malicious kind of malicious tale bearing, that kind of thing. I mean, how much of like lunchtime conversation is that in most offices, right? You know, but when you actually have a rule about it and you have to confess it, it really makes it easy to break that habit, because it is actually it's more than just, oh, it's not very nice to do, but actually no, this is serious stuff. It's actually a rule, you know. So that's actually something that really helps. That I think it makes carving the rock face even easier. So that's virtue. But I mean, if you talk about the other parts of the path, like I was saying with meditation practice, yeah, it's even more difficult than keeping virtue. So it's easier to get discouraged. But you also notice that it does actually over time, you know, even establishing a daily practice. I struggle with that for years, you know. It's like, oh, yes, I will meditate every day. But then you get busy or tired or lazy, more likely, which is actually masquerading as busy or tired. Yes, you get lazy. And you don't want to do it. And you can't get yourself to do it by telling yourself it's good for you. That's just, it's still not convincing enough. That it's only when, actually, you know, I went on a 9-day retreat somewhere, and I experienced so much benefit from it that I didn't want to waste it. Like when your mind actually feels so much cleaner, you know, you've gone to the car wash and your car is like sparkling new. Like if any kind of bird poops on it, you want to immediately wipe it away, right? Because it's like sparkling. So when your mind is kind of, you know, more like that, when anything, you know, starts to smear the windshield, you kind of want to like, no, I want to wipe it away. I want to meditate, you know. You start to feel like if you haven't meditated that day, it's kind of like, you know, you haven't taken a shower or you haven't brushed your teeth or, you know, something just feels a bit manky in your mind and you want to do something about it. So that's how actually I was able to finally start keeping to a daily practice. It was no longer coming for, this will be good for you, but that I know this is going to be good. Like, I know that it's good for me, and I enjoy the benefit of it. and I do not enjoy what happens when I don't do it. Because you start to, over time, actually have a deeper appreciation of the fruits. And that's really how you can keep cultivating whatever you're cultivating and keep doing much, whatever you need to be doing much on the path, is when you actually do it enough to start gaining momentum to see the fruits of it. So that's something which, you know, as you do it more and more, your mind almost knows the time. Like in the monastery, it's a bit easier, I suppose, than, you know, a more busy lifestyle where you can sort of have a regular time to meditate. So that even on days when you know, maybe that day was a bit more active in the monastery, there's other things we had to do or whatever, so that you might not actually be in, you know, meditation posture at 7 p.m. like usual, whatever. But even if you're doing something else, somehow, like at 7 p.m., your mind starts to feel like it's settling into that zone again, you know, like, oh, this is the time to be in that zone. And it naturally starts to go into that zone. And so you naturally want to, like, finish up your other business and, like, you know, go and sit because yeah, the groove is there deeper and there's sort of some kind of inclination or habit for the mind to go into meditation mode. And so when you start seeing that happen, then you kind of see that this process is really a process of inclination, but also it's a process of inclination where it gets easier. It almost becomes natural. So that's where, you know, the rock face, the water has gone from the mountainside and now it's, you know, it's flowing down in a bigger gush and it's just doesn't even need the gravity to keep moving. There's something else there that's pushing it along, and that's the force of that inclination that you've been building up. And, you know, it's almost when you start getting to that kind of stage, you feel like actually what the practice is about, it's almost like it's retraining your reflexes. It's like your automatic reaction to something is shifting to something else. And so in a way, you can think of practice being a practice of retraining your reflexes, you know, and reflexes that are more, you know, skillful and wholesome and that sort of thing. But by reflexes, I don't mean, you know, something so necessarily gross as like a bodily action or even a verbal action. Because sometimes, you know, the reflex you want to train is like to not do the verbal action, like to actually hold your tongue. That's something actually I've seen in my experiences being a nun is that, you know, over the years you see that actually the ability to just not say it, you know, becomes easier. And that seems like something very, like, so what? You don't say it, say what? But no, you know, to be able to just not even say gross things, like not even say like, you know, whatever curse words or like a mean word or not, but even saying like, you know how satisfying it is when you're in a situation where you can tell somebody, I told you so, right? You know, the satisfaction of that. To be able to refrain from it because, you know, it's just going to make that person feel worse, you know? Like, so that's a major victory, too, when you notice, yep, didn't say it. Didn't say it, even though itching to, even though knew the sweet satisfaction that would come from it, didn't say it because able to stop and able to just think it would make the situation worse. It's just going to make the situation worse. So better not. And so that's, yeah, that's victory. And that's like also encouragement that the grooves are growing. But there's, you know, I'm got not much time left, so I will try to keep this within time. So I will just share one last little bit, which, you know, another reflex that's a really good one to develop is just that reflex that happens when you feel some kind of disturbing emotion. You have your ones. You may have many ones. We all do. But whatever, you know, that, whether it's that arg, kind of anger, grr, you know, or the anxiety and the kind of, you know, worries, that kind of thing. When that starts to rise up in you as that ugly feeling, that sort of really unpleasant and dicey feeling, the reflex to run and to do something else, distract yourself, whatever, or continue thinking the thing and you know, making the storyline worse, rather than doing that and just shifting your reflex to actually experiencing that feeling and actually facing it and going into it and really honestly feeling it and doing nothing more than just feeling it. Like, this is actually a really powerful reflex to develop. And it's so heartening when you start seeing that when these feelings arise, that you start naturally doing that. You start naturally turning towards them rather than exit, where's the exit door, you know, and running. When you actually, the first impulse is to turn towards. Like when that starts happening, then you actually have some traction there where you're developing a capacity to look at stuff that's not easy to look at, to be with stuff that isn't easy to be with, and to be honest about it. To yourself and to other people. Yes, I still have this. It bothers me. But I'm going to feel the bother rather than make a bother about the bother. I'm just going to feel the bother. And that's something which seems so simple and humble, and yet is actually a really difficult thing to do and a wonderful thing when it becomes a reflex. So this is all another way of inclining the mind in a way that's going to take you to the Bay of Bengal, to the ocean of freedom. So I'm exactly on 45, now I'm 46, so maybe I shall stop and see if there's any questions in the room.
Thank you, Ajahn, for giving such a wonderful talk. I think BSWA should be very proud having such a good speaker from Nan Monastery. So my question is, when you are angry, it's quite easy for you to say, oh, I try to go inwards and try to look inside. So can you give me some more advice, like how to deal with anger?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the best first step, you know? Because when you actually go and feel, physically feel, whatever that anger is manifesting in your body, and it's usually some kind of tightness in your chest or some clenching of your belly, you know, that's where anger lives. These are the coordinates. Remember them in your GPS. But it should be dead obvious because, you know, anger is one of those things that, you know, it does not wear a dainty veil over its face. You know, it's pretty damn obvious where your anger is. And just when you're feeling it, you're just feeling it, you're not doing two things. You're not acting it out by yelling at somebody, saying a snide comment, boxing them, whatever, you know. You're not acting it out. But you're also not repressing it and shoving it deep down where it's like, good people, civilized people, don't get angry. I'm not angry. I'm just something else, but I'm not angry. You know? Yeah, that's the other, these are the two extremes that we tend to, these are our two main escape groups. We either act it out or we just shove it under the rug because it's, first of all, I'm not an angry person. And second of all, it's unpleasant, so I just don't want to feel it. So I'm just going to like try to shove it somewhere else so I don't have to actually feel it. But actually, it's festering under the rug. So when you're actually feeling the anger, you're not causing more damage to other people by acting it out. And you're not causing more damage to yourself by shoving it underground. Because you know where it goes when it goes underground? It goes and develops cancer cells, is what it does. And that's, you know, a lot of actually cancer comes from repressed anger. So yeah, it seems so simple, but actually it's quite life-saving. All you have to do is really just feel it. Because when you just feel it, it actually flows through you and it liberates itself. You know, you don't have to do any more than that. Like all those fancy things about recollecting about, oh, the good, you know, the good parts of the person rather than the bad parts, all that stuff is like, you can only do that when your mind is more calm. But your immediate first aid is just to feel that disturbing feeling as a wave that flows through you. Because then it takes only like less than a minute or, you know, not much more than that to shift and to release. And then when you can go back to a more neutral way of being, when your mind is a bit more neutral, then you can do those other, you know, useful reflections about whatever it is that's going to reduce your perception causing the anger, to change the perception of the situation or the person that's causing the anger. So that's the next step. Does that answer your question? Anyone else?
Oh, Venerable Munisara, yeah, wow. Thanks for the wonderful deep talk. You can give good talks.
Thank you.
Yeah. When you mentioned about continuity, you know, continuation from previous lives, mm-hmm. I was thinking about us all here in the room, you know, including those watching in YouTube, you know, okay? We could all be continuation from our previous lives, you know, to come and listen to the talk, you know. We could easily be in the pub drinking or even hooning in our motorbike, you know. But we come here to listen, you know. So, you see what I mean? We could be continuation from previous lives to enlightenment, nibbana, to end our suffering, you know.
That's right. Mm. That's right. We probably knew each other before in a previous life.
Yeah.
I'm serious, all of us. Because otherwise, we wouldn't be able to be here together sharing this experience. Mm. So we have all been inclining our minds somehow in the same direction. Mm. That's why our we're meeting, like the streams that are, you know, flowing into the same Ganges River. Mm. So that's something actually very beautiful. Mm. And that's something which, you know, what I really appreciate is when in the course of 1 week, you know, I can see the same person at Bodhinyana, then at Dhammasara, then at Dhammaloka, all in the same week.
Mm.
Because what that shows me whenever I see that is that these people are inclining their minds at a great frequency. Mm-hmm. and the thing is, they're not bored. It's not like, oh, I've done it 3 times already this week. You know, I just saw you at Dhammasara 2 days ago, but it's like, I saw you at Dhammasara, see you on Friday, coming to your talk. You know, like that enthusiasm for the Dhamma is what keeps us inclining towards it. Mm. Because it's no longer just, oh, I know this is good for me, I should go to the gym, I should listen to the Dharma, I should meditate, blah, blah, blah. No, what's powering it now is the genuine enthusiasm, because we know it works. And it has lightened our load, lightened our suffering in our own lives and the lives of the people we know who practice it. So we are enthused. And so we keep coming back to the iconic blue carpet. And we, you know, we keep listening, we keep meditating. And that's, yeah, we've probably been doing this in previous lives, because there are people who are like, what, Friday night, you're going to go and meditate and listen to some weird nun talk about what, you know? Yeah, they're going to be brim brim on their motorcycle. Mm. So yeah, they're inclining their minds a different way. So aren't we lucky? Like, feeling so lucky. That's why I felt so happy when I said I felt happy. I'm happy to be here, both for myself, but to be here in such great company.
Mm.
To be here in such august company of committed and dedicated practitioners who have been doing this again and again, not only in this lifetime, but sure as heck, you know, previous lifetimes. So who knows how close we are to that ocean.
Yes.
Right.
I'm just thinking we are all stream entrants, which we don't know, and we are close to Nibbana too, which we don't know, you know?
That's
especially
right.
Especially the sanghas, the monks and nuns.
Yes, we don't know. Yeah, but you know, that's the thing, we don't know, but we certainly, don't you feel that you can, right? You know, I don't know if it's too much to say you can smell the sea breeze, but you can feel you're inclining in the right direction because you're happier, right? And when you're not happy, it don't last as long. I mean, it's not to say there are not periods when you are not happy. Let's not overstate ourselves. But at least it don't last as long. And it doesn't have as much grip, you know, and much heaviness that's like forever and ever kind of feeling. So that means you're inclining. That's how you know. You don't need a map to show you where's the east. You know, you have your internal map, which is your own sense of how happy am I, genuinely happy? And how long am I troubled when I'm troubled? And how aware can I be of either one of those states? And how peaceful can I be with either one of those states? And how sure can I be that neither of them last? So, you know, just sit tight. Just sit tight. Because even this ugh feeling, it's going away. And even this blissful light feeling, can't keep it in your pocket. So the more you're able to be with that and be with that fleeting nature of everything more often, then that's you're in the right direction. So yeah, I don't know if anyone here smells any sea breeze yet, but congratulations if you do.
Well, just quickly, do you think there'll be some indication to tell us too that we're in the right path?
I think that's it. That's the classic indication, is are your wholesome mind states increasing? Mm-hmm. Are your unwholesome mind states decreasing? Mm-hmm. And is your suffering
less suffering, more peaceful?
Yeah. And you know, sometimes though it takes a while, you have to give yourself a bit of a chance of collecting the data. Mm. You can't just look at it too narrowly that I've had one bad moment or one bad morning, one bad day, or one bad few days. You know, you gotta like widen the perspective, because we're talking lifetimes, right? So if you even had, you know, just, Yeah, I think that that's a really, you know, sort of can't go wrong kind of indication. Because who can tell that to you? You can. This doesn't rely on... I can tell you some funny stories about, you know, sort of chasing psychic monks who would be able to tell me about the, you know, the state of my mind, when actually, you know, the most psychic person is yourself. You know the state of your mind. You can learn to know the state of your own mind, and then you don't have to be chasing down these obscure monasteries and these obscure corners where all sorts of mishaps happened, and the psychic person doesn't actually, you know, do what you want them to do. I'll tell you those other stories another day. But yeah. So you know that for yourself with that kind of guideline.
Thank you. Waiting for your next talk.
Thank you, Uncle.
Any other questions?
Online questions. Yes. Okay. So I'm not sure how many questions am I supposed to do? Like, how long are we supposed to carry on for?
I don't know, but I just want to say thank you.
Hmm?
I'm over here.
Oh, there's, okay.
I just want to say thank you, and you just did so well.
Oh, thank you very much.
I just think that it's a calling. It's if you're here, it's because it's a calling.
Yes.
It's just goodness. Just goodness. You must be a good person.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Yes, the calling is, you know, the call of not the sound of music, you know. Okay, so a question from Bolivia. Wow, Bolivia. I wonder what I'm born from karma means. Could it mean that by the repetition of some kind of actions, our personalities are created? Or that phrase means something different? You mean the one about I am the owner of my karma, heir of my karma, born of my karma. Right, that one, okay. I think it's born of my karma. But you're born of my karma in the sense that, yeah, your past actions determined this birth, and not only this physical birth of that baby that goes crying out of the, you know, out the birth canal into the big bad world of back in samsara, it's not only that kind of birth, but it's that birth in every moment. Where does this moment come from? If you're feeling angry in this moment, where does that come from? It comes from you've been angry before in the past. And you have made that neural pathway in your mind that is going to look at the situation and think, grr. That is how, yes, the repetition of some kind of action is going to create a personality. Because what is personality but a collection of idiosyncratic habits, which makes you, uniquely you, but not so unique, because basically you are just a permutation of a different formula and ratio of greed, hatred, and delusion. So if your karma and habit pattern has been of the kind of, let's say, the anger, because we're talking about that, and you just have a tendency. Oh gosh, you know, when you live in a monastery, you can see the different tendencies, and there's a, yeah, you know, bless their souls, they're rosy cheeked, and sparkling souls, but you could look at, I can't think of a actual example, but you could look at somebody who. I don't know, I know. Now is a season of like rats and like, you know, rodents getting to the places they shouldn't be in the monastery. And there are people with the anger neural pathway who will be like, oh no, vermin disease, get out of the kitchen, man, off the stainless steel benches, please. Like, you know, like they will look at this and see the negative aspect of the rat, which is like, yes, you are nothing but a big germ ball. And then they will feel displeased with this. And then someone with the habit pattern of maybe looking at the beauty in things will be like, oh, he's so cute. Oh, but he's so cute. And I'm like, it's a rodent, but he's so cute. he needs to be trapped and taken away from the kitchen. But isn't he cute? Yeah, so then you have the habit pattern of, you know, seeing the beauty. And that's born of your kama, because you've done it again and again and before. So instantly you see a rat and you see what a cute little fella. And that's just instant. That's the positive reflex. So yeah, we are born of our kama in that way. But the thing is, kama is malleable. So, you know, there are people of the school of thought that you just can't change people and you just can't change yourself. So why even try? Right? Yeah. Yeah, those are the people who also were like, what? This is the Himalayas. How are you going to be able to carve anything into a sheer rock face? Right? But then what did the Ganges River do? Right? And what are you doing when you become aware of your anger and you don't act it out? What are you doing but just creating different patterns, new kama? And if you repeat that new kama of just feeling your anger and not acting it out, then you are changing your personality. And this can be something that you can see within this lifetime. And you can see in your own, if you have relatives, right? You know, that you've lived with over time, you can see how they've changed over time. You can see how you yourself have changed over time. And so when we say we're born of our kama, it's true, but it doesn't mean we're like doomed to our kama, you know? We're born of certain kama, but we're continuously making new kama that is going to change the direction of our river. So, yes. Okay. Do people want me to take another one from the internet? Or I don't know what the rules are here. Or shall I call? There's someone on the floor here. Yep.
Maybe refer to it more as unlearning bad habits?
I guess you could, but I guess it's kind of more difficult to wrap your mind about how you unlearn something. It's more like that's more of like an expression. That's like a turn of phrase.
Maybe keeping that in mind might be.
I'm sorry?
Maybe keeping that in mind though, you know, maybe.
I'm sorry, I'm not catching that last phrase.
Maybe keeping that in mind, though, like that you've learned this.
Right. I guess what you can do, you can think of it as you're beginning to see a fork in the road, you know? Like, rather than saying unlearning an old pattern, maybe you can say that you're just learning there's a different route you can take.
Okay, yep.
And so... gaining a dexterity in taking the new road, right? Like if there's a certain route you always used to take from your house to Dhammaloka, but they built a new road or something that makes it quicker, then you start learning how to take that new road. And suddenly, before you just know, oh, you get into your car, automatic pilot, turn right. Blah, blah. But then now you're starting like, no, wait, turn left. Now we're turning left. So it's like, yes, in a way you're unlearning the habit to turn right. Because you're gaining a greater familiarity with turning left until that becomes a reflex. And so that's how we can work with our habit patterns. That's
so
true.
Taking a new direction.
Yeah, one that's taking you to the east, to the ocean. That's right. So that's how we can think of it. Okay. So maybe I'll do one more from the internet just to be fair to the internet people.
You can do as many as you like, if you like.
I'm sorry?
You can do as many as you like.
Oh, really? Y'all want... Okay, well, I don't want to keep people from...
Them all.
Okay, I'll do one more and see how we go. Question from Denmark. I've tried doing a meditation retreat at home, but in the evening I get so bored, so I watch television. Any advice? Yeah, that's the tricky thing about doing meditation retreat at home, because home still has the TV set. Whereas if you do it at, you know, a meditation retreat center, they will not provide you with a TV set. And they will confiscate your phones, so you cannot, you know, Netflix or whatever on your phone. So, so I guess what you can do is you can somehow, like, do something with your TV. Put a cloth over it. You know, I'm serious. Even that helps. Like, even though you know you can unveil the cloth, there's like that psychological barrier of like, no, no, I've set the intention that I'm not going to watch TV during the meditation retreat. So you can, you know, first of all, do something with the distractions that are tempting you, something physical, you know, or you can unplug it. And I guess it's not that hard to plug it back again, but maybe you can get somebody fancy to put a code in it that you don't know. But that's one thing. But the real way, though, is to actually do exactly the same with anger. Learn to be with boredom, you know? Because boredom also is just a feeling that's fleeting. And you can feel it somewhere in the body. It's not as obvious as anger, but you can find it somewhere in your body. And get really interested in what boredom's like so that you're not bored with being bored. You're like writing a PhD dissertation on boredom. You're collecting the data that you're going to be fascinated by. Like, yeah, how long does boredom last? If I don't say, oh, I'm so bored, how long does it actually last? And yeah, like actually, if I were to ask you, point to boredom. Where is boredom when you feel it? Point. Hey, that's kind of an interesting thing to do. Right? You're like, well, point, where is it? Yeah, where is it? And time it for me. How long is that boredom felt constantly, exactly the same? And then what made it shift? What made it shift? Not your television, you didn't turn on the television, but what actually made your boredom shift? It could have been a stray thought about whatever. It's so random, but what is it? So you could get really interested in your own boredom. And that actually is a valid meditation object. Like, don't think that, oh, I have to watch the breath and meditation is watching the breath. No, meditation is watching whatever is presenting itself in its most beguiling way in the present moment. So boredom can also be beguiling. You know, it's just how you look at her. So rather than think, oh, boredom, think boredom. What a fascinating personality. Boredom. She's so mysterious. What does she really like to do? Does she like tennis? Or soccer? You know, get to know boredom because she don't talk to anyone. She only talks to people she likes. So are you going to be one she likes? So yeah, you know, yeah, get to know boredom in a friendly way. So that's boredom. Okay, last question. I'm 23-year-old female. The more I meditate, the more I feel like I want to become a nun. The thought scared me because you're like, I might become like you, right? Right, understandable, scary. But I've had this thought for 2 years and it's growing stronger. What should I do? Well, what you should do is you should watch The Sound of Music and see what is your reaction in that scene where Maria leaves the convent. And that'll be your litmus test, your immediate reaction. And that will be a sign. And then Rent, what was it? Audrey Hepburn in like A Nun's Story. All these movies, they're always about Catholic nuns because these are made in the West. But anyway, and see how you feel at the end of that. And the scene when she takes, you know, I did watch a lot of movie about nuns. I like that one too. You know, when you know, they become wedded to Christ or something like that. That's like the last scene, I think, where she becomes a nun. And see how you feel. Do you feel like, yeah, like, go Audrey. Like, do you feel like that? Okay, so that's one that you do. But the other thing you could do is, why be scared? What's wrong with being a nun, right? It's like, let me tell you, a lot of fun. Genuinely a lot of fun. And also like a life of real meaning and a real sense of fulfillment. So don't be scared. But yes, any kind of sort of abrupt career move is a little bit scary. So at 23, you might be thinking, I'm going to become a corporate warrior or whatever it is. And you're like, what? I'm going to become a nun? Yeah, it is kind of scary. So the way to unscare or, you know, to lessen the scariness is actually go see it. I mean, this question doesn't say where it's from, but if you're anywhere near where there is some kind of a nun's monastery, just go visit, you know, for the day, you know. Just go like at Dhammasar, we're open every day for visitors. You can just come and you don't even have to bring dana, you know. You can just come and see and just, you know, chat to one of us and, you know, see that we're relatively sane. And that might scare you less. But also just to get a feel, like, you don't have to be like, oh my God, the only way I'm going to find out what's to become a nun and is to become, you know, yeah, already become a nun, and that's the only way I have to find out. No, I mean, you just go for a day visit, and if you think, oh, it seems kind of interesting, doesn't seem too scary, then you can maybe come and stay for like a day or two or whatever, and just get a feel for it, and yeah, and just sort of go at your own pace, what you feel comfortable with. But the thing is, you're never going to know until you actually experience it. So whether you start to experience it as just a lay visitor, you know, then fine. And then if you experience it and you find, oh, actually, I kind of seems to, you know, you have a positive vibe when you go to a monastery or a nun's monastery, and you have a positive vibe when you stay there, then you just take it from there. But, you know, there's no like time frame. It's very personal. And no one can tell you when you're ready. And there's no wrong answer of when you have to be ready or when you have to know. And you don't have to be like that lovely Sri Lankan nun who just saw the Buddha blink at her and instantly knew. You know, like, we don't all have to be like that. And we're not all going to be like that. But we just have to go at our own, what's true to us. And then you could go and, you know, you could hate it. And that's fine too. Like, it's just an exploration. And it's like one of those things where maybe today it doesn't feel right, or maybe today you feel you're interested but you're a little bit scared, because I know that feeling, because I nursed this feeling for a long time. And I remember the first time I went to stay at a nun's monastery, it wasn't a forest monastery. I was like, wow, this place isn't very clean. I was kind of like turned off by the fact that it wasn't very clean. And that was enough for me to be like, I don't think I'm ready to become a nun. I need to find a cleaner monastery. No, I mean, anyway, but I'm just saying, you know, your first reaction may not be like, wow, you still might become a nun. So then it's just take it at your own pace and explore. So that's what I would say. And I guess I'll just do the last question quickly. Oh no, I can't, because it's like, well, yeah, okay, I'll do it a little bit though. So question from Singapore, how can I fix mistakes in a relationship? I guess you could be in any kind of relationship here. It doesn't have to be a romantic relationship. Any kind of relationship with another person that goes wonky, because we are humans and they have a tendency to go wonky when we have to deal with other humans, because humans, we are so different. And we are all like baffling. Some other humans, they are just baffling to you, and you are baffling to them. And so you kind of, when you get together, baffling things happen that don't feel good on either side. Then first of all, if you made, I don't know what you mean by mistake, but I guess a mistake is something where somehow it ends up not feeling good on either side. Then first of all, try to just own up to it, that, okay, maybe I said the wrong thing or did the wrong thing in that moment. And it's good that you actually are already calling it a mistake, because that means you're willing to admit it. That's the first thing. To just be willing to admit that, yeah, okay, maybe something went wrong here. Maybe both on both our sides. And the hard part is to try to communicate about it. Yeah, I mean, I struggle with this one, because sometimes people aren't ready to talk to you about it. And then you can't push it. So, you know, with these things, maybe I'll just say that I guess what you try to do is somehow have both parties in the relationship somehow be able to, if you can, come to a point where you can talk it over. And just because you will be amazed at, like, their viewpoint on it, like I said, baffling. Like it would be completely different from yours. And so you're seeing the same thing in completely different ways, and that's why there's some kind of friction. But if you could even just get a glimpse into how the other person sees it, and if they could even get a glimpse into how you see it, that even opening of minds on both sides is what allows the tension to at least shift a bit, because you're widening your perspective and you're opening your heart to the other person. And so that's something always very positive. But it's important to just make sure your mind is in the right place before you try to do that. When you're trying to fix something in a relationship, it's not just about, I don't like this yucky feeling, let's get rid of this yucky feeling when the relationship is going not so good. But actually, like, am I in a good mind frame when I actually really want, out of care for the other person, to do something so that relationship improves? Or it's something I want it so I get it good, or I'm right, or something. I mean, see where you're coming from and make sure it's coming from a place where you're really trying to heal it for both sides. And then that's where it can actually perhaps have a chance. But and if, even if it doesn't, like, it's still worth trying. And also relationships are like a minefield. So like, yeah, kind of you have to accept it at one level that, yeah, it's going to be messy and not always very nice. And that's okay, you know? So yeah, so good luck. You know, good luck to you and to me and to everybody else in this room. So I think I've carried on for already quite long, so maybe it's enough to call it a night before I get kicked out. So thank you everybody for your questions. Okay, so now she's prompting me because I don't know what to do. So now we bow.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavataṃ abhivādeyi svakkhato bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sango sangang namami.